LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is John Michael Greer, who joins us to discuss the origins and potential outcome of the European Union's ongoing meltdown. The recent Brexit referendum in the UK was never meant to happen. The result of a miscalculated attempt by former British Prime Minister David Cameron to neutralise the right-wing UK Independence Party, Brexit has plunged the nation into a constitutional crisis. While approximately 48% of the electorate voted for the UK to remain within the European Union, 52% voted to leave. As a result, the country is now deeply divided, and the rancour of a bitterly fought campaign has merely intensified since the outcome became clear. The total lack of planning for a vote to quit the EU is also starkly evident in the chaotic infighting and backstabbing that has marred the political aftermath. So just how did this unintended mayhem come about? At the core of the crisis, but unacknowledged by the political class, mainstream media, and population at large, are serious systemic problems affecting the economy, the environment, and the very foundations of our industrial society. These problems existed before Brexit, and they exist now. They would have remained exactly the same whether we voted leave or remain. The problems are global and they are not going away. They are, in fact, getting worse. For evidence of this, one need only observe the utter farce masquerading as the current US presidential election, or, closer to home, the ominous rise of the far right in most, if not all, European Union countries. Until these harsh realities are fully faced, the pundits, pollsters, and politicians will continue to get it wrong. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux, and the sky is black with birds coming home to roost. When they do, they will reorder this world. Hello and welcome, John, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on again.
Now, John, today we're going to be, the title of the talk, rather ostentatiously from me, is The Truth About Brexit, which is, you know... That's certainly saying something that we're going to be offering that, but we're going to be offering a nuanced take on recent political events here in Britain. Now, in my introduction, I've set out basically what has been going on, just in case anyone has in fact been living under a rock for the last 6 months. Before we dive into all that, just tell listeners a little bit about yourself and your work in general.
A little bit. That's a little complex these days. But at any rate, I'm a writer, essayist. I write on a variety of subjects. One of them is the future of industrial society. That has directed me to pay a lot of attention to some of the recent political changes because, I mean, politics is to some extent the froth on top of the beer of society. But very often, sometimes there are situations where political shifts can show major realignments in society, and this is an example of it. So I've been paying attention to the Brexit thing, and generally to the discontent with the EU in various parts of Europe, as with the Donald Trump phenomenon over on this side of the pond. There's been a lot of very similar shouting about those phenomena on both sides of the Atlantic. And that's not inappropriate because in both cases, there are some similar things going on.
Quite. Now, it's saying something, I think, in some people's estimation, that I've turned to you, an American, to comment on this most British of goings-on. But as I mentioned to you off-air, people are so emotionally and ideologically wrapped up in this at the minute that whatever people think privately, whatever they think in the wee small hours in their more lucid moments, it doesn't really come across in any of the discussion and debate. It seems, you know, to be extremely polarized, and whether people feel they need to take these positions or not, I mean, people are still reeling from the events, I think.
Well, there are several things going on here, and I think probably the best way is to back up a little bit and look at Brexit in its political context, because it shows, as I mentioned, something, a fairly serious realignment that's beginning to take shape. Let's back up here for a moment to the advent of Tony Blair and New Labour, okay, back in the 90s. What nobody was, or very few people were willing to talk about at that time, and very few people are talking about now, is the extent to which, at that point, the Labour Party basically quietly walked away from its old commitments to the interests of the working classes. It became, as the Democratic Party did over on this side of the pond, it became a party of affluent liberals. And it focused its interests on the causes that were of interest to affluent liberals. It was a great way to kind of carve out a chunk of the voters who had ended up going to Thatcher and to the Tories. But, of course, that left ordinary working people in Britain and elsewhere, within Britain, with no place to turn that actually was supporting their interests. Now, a lot of what we're seeing going on in the Brexit controversy is the playing out of that phenomenon. Okay, I'm going to say a couple of very controversial things here. I consider them to be quite not fairly easy to demonstrate, fairly straightforward, but you do not say them in polite, that is to say, relatively affluent company. Unrestricted immigration drives down wages. Simple supply and demand. If you have X number of jobs and you double the number of people who are trying to get those jobs, you're going to drive wages down. Okay? Unrestricted movement of capital drives down wages because it furthers the offshoring of jobs, moving jobs away from, say, Britain to various parts of Southern and Eastern Europe where the wages are lower. Okay? Both of those policies are very strongly supported by the EU. Both of them are very strongly supported by the Labour Party, and in fact by most of the parties in British public life. They're very good for people who are in the upper middle classes and the upper classes, people who are economically comfortable, who get a salary, who don't have to compete for those wage jobs that immigrants are very eager to take up. But both of those policies are, as I said, very bad for the working classes. That's the unspeakable thing. Nobody wants to say out loud, well, I mean, a few people have, obviously, within this Brexit thing, but they've been generally shouted down, that there's actually a cogent, straightforward economic reason to object to unrestricted immigration, to object to the free movement of capital. These are not value-neutral things. They benefit certain people, and they cost others. Okay. That is the thing that nobody in the Remain campaign was willing to talk about. And I've noticed, you know, sitting on the other side of the Atlantic watching the British media while all this unfolded, if anybody tried to talk about it, the immediate result was to shout them down, insist they were racist, xenophobes, Nazis, morons, schoolyard insults flung at anybody who raised the possibility that maybe there was an actual issue here. I understand there are very strong passions over these things. There are very strong passions over anything that brushes against racism. Is racism a problem? Of course it is. But there are reasons to object to unrestricted immigration that are not just racism. And that's the thing that nobody in the Remain, in fact, very few people in British public life are willing to talk about. On the other hand, as we saw when it came down to the election, did you notice that the polls were basically turned out to be wrong? All the polls were saying that, well, probably Remain by a bit or Remain by a landslide, blah, blah, blah. And then people actually went into the privacy of the voting booth, and a huge number of them voted to leave. Partly this is the effect of all those people yelling, you're racist, you know, if you object to immigration, if you object to the unrestricted movement of capital, all these things, which, as I've said, have been driving the working class down into poverty and misery. If you object to those, you must be a racist. So a lot of people simply kept their mouths shut. Even talking to pollsters, they kept their mouths shut. They mouthed the approved sound bites. And then they went into into the privacy of the voting booth and cast their vote for leave.
Okay, I was going to come to immigration and movement of capital later, but seeing as you've gone straight to it, the thing
here... It's the core of the whole issue. Go ahead.
Yeah, the thing here is that, like, I've got a bit of an anarchist streak in me. I admit that, you know, sometimes when the cards get thrown up in the air, I kind of like, ooh, what's going to happen, you know? But talking to friends and colleagues that I have who are upset about this Brexit result, they, of course, are saying, as I would sign on for this as well, of course it's good that people from other countries can come here and take part, anyone settle and make a life if they like the country and work here and raise a family. And I'd like to think that if I wanted to go to France or Germany, that they would say, yes, you know, come here and be part of our life. Welcome, you stranger. You know, that is something that most reasonable people have as a default. It's like, you know, why would we not want to meet people from other cultures, and why wouldn't share the country with them? That's the instinct. That's what kicks in for people when they're they're objecting to this. So the question is, how do you square that basic, good, welcoming, natural human instinct to, you know, to meet your fellow humans and welcome them into your home? And how does that sit with this other side, this economic reality, the cold, hard facts that say, oh, well, there's a problem here, and oh look, there's a problem over there. You know, that's I see the tension in people's minds. They don't want to say maybe there might be a problem, you know, with immigration, because it goes against the core of their being. You know,
well, now there's some complicated things here, because first of all, even though, you know, it's nice to think about, you go to France, you want to go to France, you want to go to Germany, maybe you want to move to Poland. You're not doing that, and neither are a lot of other people. It's all very well to talk about, you know, being willing to come, you know, go wherever you want to and settle down and raise a family. But let's face it, Britain right now cannot provide adequate jobs, adequate housing, adequate social services for the people it's already got. And so, in the real world, it's very nice to have to try to make everything line up with a single ideal, but life doesn't work that way. So you need to start looking at, okay, what are the actual consequences of putting this ideal into effect, and do we need to look at other ways of doing things? Do we need to notice, for example, that one consequence of this sort of open door policy is the driving down of standards of living to the lowest common denominator? It's one of the things that you don't hear talked about in the broader sense, you know, when we're looking at opening our doors, not only to, say, people from other parts of Europe, but what about people from, you know, Asia and Africa? In the abstract, it's a great idea. In terms of actual economics, you're talking about a situation which would drive down the standard of living across the world to that of, say, Ghana. If you're okay with that, that's fine. But I think most of the people who are talking about that are not really thinking about, okay, do I want to live in a society where the standard of living is that of Ghana? Do I want to live in a third world country? Not because there are people who are with brown skins. We're not talking about that. We're talking about standards of living, economic realities. Do I want that kind of lifestyle? It's very easy to say, well, no, we should raise the standard of living of the people of Ghana up to that. And, you know, great. Let's see that happen. But unrestricted immigration may not be the way to do it. And so we are in an awkward situation where ideals and realities do not necessarily work together. It's the job of the political process to square that. And are the results are going to be awkward? Of course. Are there going to be ugly compromises made? Are we going to have to say, well, you know, this is the ideal, but we're not going to be able to do it right now? Yes. Are we going to have to say, well, we have this goal, we have that goal, we can't have both, what are we going to choose? That's what politics is all about. That's what government should be about. And so, you know, just taking the abstract ideal of open borders and saying, oh, sure, wonderful, we should do that. You know, again, you can do that if you want to, but there are consequences. And I think a lot of, obviously, a majority of people in Britain, or a majority of the people who voted, looked at those consequences and said, no.
One of the most incredible things about all of this, you know, having been observing the British political scene for about 30 years, since I was way too young to actually have an interest in this sort of thing, but I did anyway. I've seen some stuff, but this mm-hmm. recent thing takes the biscuit, because this was never meant to happen. And for people who don't know, I'll just briefly explain the background here. You had the Conservative Party, now the party of government here, and in the last administration, they were in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, the third party in the UK, as it was at the time, behind Labour. So they were in a coalition because they couldn't form a government on their own, and whatever the instincts of the Conservative Party were, the Liberal Democrats acted as a brake on that. They kept saying no to things. David Cameron, the until recently British Prime Minister, in going into the last election, he calculated that they were not, once again, not going to be able to form a government on their own. They'd probably end up in a coalition with the Liberals again. He then, to ward off the threats coming from the right wing of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, who were anti-EU, he said, okay, we'll have your referendum then, calculating they'd be in coalition with the Liberal Democrats and they would nix it. And he could then hold up his hands and say, well, look, I tried. Mm-hmm. Much to the amazement of almost everyone, the Conservatives actually won an outright victory. Now, at this stage, mm-hmm. Cameron could still have rolled the dice and said, oh, well, I've changed my mind about the referendum, it's off. Who knows what the cost would have been, but could it really have been worse than what's happened in terms of his own career? So anyway, he goes ahead with the referendum, once again calculating, well, there's no way people are actually going to vote to leave. And then they did, and all hell broke mm-hmm. loose. And that's where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would argue that there again, with the in the last general election in 2015, Cameron did not, nobody really realized how many people were actually in favor of leaving the EU. I think what happened in that election is that a lot of people who normally vote Labour, or normally vote, or probably a lot fewer Lib Dems, but a lot of the sort of the working class Labour supporters, the people who turned out in very large numbers to vote for Brexit, voted Tory in that election because they wanted the referendum. They didn't tell anyone. Again, they did the polls were wrong. The pollsters were gobsmacked. Because, you know, they, as you said, they'd been looking at another hung parliament, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of people who apparently said they were going to vote Labour or Lib Dem voted Tory, and there we go. Again, when you make, when the climate of discussion has become such that certain things can't be talked about, then people don't necessarily talk about them, they just go and vote. One of the real problems, if I may reiterate here, is the way that certain things have been ruled out of discussion. Things, you know, you can't talk about that. If you bring this up, you're going to be shouted down, you know, with shouts of Nazi and, you know, moron or what have you. And so you're right that it is, you know, that this was a phenomenally unexpected event in terms of the sort of conventional wisdom of British politics. But I think it shows that there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the conventional wisdom of British politics. And I think what would have happened if Cameron had turned around after the election and said, well, I lied, I'm not going to do a referendum after all, is that UKIP would have just kept on growing. One of the things that I've said several times now, when people have been going, oh, we've got to have a second referendum, and saying, do you really want, this was before he stepped out, of course, but do you really want Nigel Farage in number 10 Downing Street? Because that's the way that's the best way to get him there. So many people have obviously turned their back on the conventionalism. They will vote for anybody who will get Britain out of the EU. And if that means UKIP, a UKIP government, God help us, that's what it means. So, you know, kind of an awkward prospect, but seriously, the sort of movers and shakers, the people whose opinion, quote, matters, unquote, really need to take into account the fact that a very large section of the British voting public is not buying it anymore.
Well, in my reading of the situation prior to the referendum, I found mm-hmm. that a lot of people from all walks of society, not everyone, of course, but, you know, rather larger numbers than you would have liked, were really mm-hmm. quite ignorant about the EU itself, you know, mm-hmm. what it does, how it functions. I mean, the number of people Googling what is the EU prior to the referendum was staggering. And there were undoubtedly a lot of votes that were cast that were not explicitly about the EU itself. They were about things like immigration, about just perceived threat of the other, and general conditions, you know, as you say, industrial jobs being offshored, and people just having a rough old time of it for a long time. And the EU was almost neither here nor there for some people. It was more just a symbol of something in their minds that they wanted to fix, you know, hopefully with just the stroke of a pen.
Well, and equally, of course, a lot of the people who support the EU have no clue as to what it actually amounts to. It's simply a warm feeling of international brotherhood. That, you know, modern public life is like that. But the fact that now of course there's another factor here that deserves attention, which is the fact that the Remain campaign was frankly one of the most impressively incompetent political campaigns I have watched in years. Watching David Cameron, you know, stomping around going, "Well, if you vote Leave, you'll all get cancer." Seriously, the threats. I mean, I actually saw somebody had done up a faux headline, you know, Brexit will give you cancer, experts warn, and making fun of this endless parade of threats of, you know, this horrible thing will happen and that horrible thing will happen. And the Remain campaign was a complete one-note Johnny about that. I didn't, maybe they did it somewhere else, but I did not see anybody anywhere trying to make a coherent argument in favor of Britain belonging to the EU. It was all, well, you know, any thinking person ought to blah blah blah. If you don't support the EU, you're a Nazi moron. And if we leave the EU, these horrible things will happen. That does not go over well, especially when you had Cameron and Osborne and people going, you know, if we leave the EU, there are going to be cuts to the National Health Service. Well, you know, what have the Tories been doing? I mean, Brexit means what we're already doing just doesn't have the same sort of threat value that I think they thought it had. And so it was a very badly run campaign. And it's possible that if somebody had been able to articulate a coherent, positive vision for why Britain should remain in the EU, it's possible that the Remain side would have won. But they didn't. And I'll point out also that if you have people who recognize that there are serious issues, real issues, like the issues with immigration and offshoring driving down wages and plunging much of working class Britain into a state of permanent destitution, if that's a real issue and you're aware of that, and every time you try to bring that up, if some affluent liberal points at you and says, you're just a Nazi moron, this is not going to make you want to listen to them. This is not going to convince you that their ideas are worth listening to. And yet that has been nearly the only response over and over again when anybody tries to bring up the economic consequences. You know, just schoolyard insults, put downs, sneers. And then they wonder why thousands upon thousands upon thousands of unemployed working class people across the north of Britain who normally vote Labour, turned out and voted Leave.
Yeah, I was quite disenchanted with the tone of the debate from both sides, really, because there was undoubtedly some parts of the Remain campaign were peddling exaggerated threats, as you mentioned, including giant locusts, which I had to chuckle at. And
I missed the giant locust. That's pretty good.
Well, apparently there was going to be a plague of them.
Ahead.
So, some parts of the Leave campaign, I felt were peddling exaggerated promise, because they were saying that it's milk and honey, and I just felt there was no way of knowing that. It was either way, there was an unknown. A lot of people said, oh, well, if we were to leave the EU, we're entering into the unknown. But, I mean, to be fair, staying in the EU was an unknown in the sense that the future is unknown, if you see what I mean. So I'm not coming down condemning anyone more than the other, but the whole the public debate anyway, I'm not sure what sort of discussions people were having around the dinner table, but the public debates from commentators and politicians and pundits was really, really, really dispiriting.
Oh, it was, no question. But you notice the difference. The Remain campaign was almost entirely negative. And the Leave campaign, while it was equally dishonest, no argument there, it was pushing a positive vision. It was saying, we are going to these things are going to change and they're going to make your life better. And that was enough to, even though it was fraudulent in important ways. You know, there all of these umpty million pounds a week were not going to suddenly land in the coffers of the National Health Service, and so on. The fact that they had a positive vision to offer and the Remain people did not is a very important lesson. It's a lesson which, by the way, applies very specifically to the current American scene, where we're having a version of the same thing going on right now.
Yeah, one of the things I've been doing. When I've not had very many conversations with friends about this as yet, but I've been sort of coming in at a slightly different angle and saying, well, there are meta trends here, global things going on that are feeding into this, and it's not unique to the UK. Now, the UK situation has its own little unique features, but I said, if you look around the world, you know, for example, I've heard people railing against, you know, that sort of, oh, I don't want to live in a fascist country, referring to the UK. And I think, well, I don't think there are any more racist or fascist than there were in the 70s or whatever. And certainly you can look at the Front National in France and other groups in places like Germany, Poland, even in liberal Sweden. There are some of the same trends in place. Now, I want to quote from your recent blog post about this, and you can maybe shed some light on this. It feeds into what I've just been saying. The core issues underlying the Brexit referendum are also massive realities in many other countries right now, and will likely play a very large role, probably quite a decisive one, in this year's presidential race here in the United States. Now, if you could speak to that, because it really puts all of this in a bigger context.
Okay, I'm going to start with the United States, and then we can go to some of the other European countries, because, yeah, there's a common pattern that you find throughout the Western, more or less democratic societies. Actually, let me start by making a comment about that word fascist, okay? That's a word that people on the left love to throw around. Have you ever noticed that nobody actually knows what it means? Aldous Huxley, back when fascism was still an issue, pointed out in an essay of his that, as far as he could tell, it simply meant something of which one ought to disapprove. It had become completely content-free, okay? The fact that Britain is leaving the EU does not make it a fascist state. I mean, where are the goose-stepping stormtroopers? Where is the party ideology? Where is, you know, the statues of the glorious leader? All the things that actually make fascism fascism. You know, I'm sorry, the thought of, Theresa May, you know, sitting there with an armband or something, she doesn't cut it, let's just face it. The term fascism has become a scare word. It's used purely as a put-down. And I think I would strongly encourage anybody who likes using it to actually take the time to learn, to find out what it means, read some good books about actual fascist societies, like, say, Mussolini's Italy, or of course, the example everyone defaults to, Nazi Germany, which was, again, National Socialist rather than fascist. They're not the same thing. Do some research, learn what you're talking about. Don't write, as Tom Lehrer pointed out, don't write naughty words on walls if you can't spell or if you don't actually know what they mean. Okay. Setting that aside for a moment, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is running essentially a Remain campaign. The only thing, she's offering business as usual. She's, you know, Obama's comment of her back 8 years ago. You know, she'll promise anything and change nothing. Remains exactly true. She's the candidate of the status quo, and her entire campaign is basically based around either stealing soundbites from her recent opponent, Bernie Sanders, or talking about how dreadful Donald Trump is. And her followers, her supporters, are all, oh, Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump. And it's not working. It's not working at all. Donald Trump, Trump's campaign remains more or less level with her right now. And the polls are up and down. Sometimes Trump is ahead, sometimes Clinton's ahead. And we haven't yet seen the opening barrage of the kind of all-on attack that he used to level his Republican opponents. Right now, as things stand, Donald Trump is probably going to be the next president of the United States. Now, again, when that prospect is brought up, everybody on the leftward end of things in this part of the country starts yelling, oh my God, if you support Trump, you must be a fascist moron. It's the same, exactly the same language. Donald Trump is talking about exactly the same issues that I argue underlie the Brexit vote. Unrestricted immigration and offshoring of jobs. He's been talking about that in speech after speech after speech, and nobody of his, none of his opponents want to talk about that. This is why he has, I think, a very, very high chance of winning in November in our general election, because he's talking about an issue that the other people aren't willing to deal with. He's presenting an alternative to the continuation of a mode of business as usual that is absolutely unbearable to the majority of Americans. Right now in America today, unless you're in the salary class, unless you're, you know, one of the affluent, your chance of getting a full-time job is almost nil. There are, quote, jobs being created all the time, but if you actually look at it, the number of hours being worked remains flat or declines, because what's happening is they're taking full-time jobs, laying people off, and then hiring back a couple of part-timers. So we have people in the working class who are desperately trying to survive, working two and three part-time jobs at starvation wages with no benefits. That's our economic recovery. That's business as usual. That's the thing that, the policies that Hillary Clinton supports are making possible. And Donald Trump is offering an alternative. Is it an honest alternative? Probably not. Is he actually going to do the things he says he is? I have real questions about that. But the fact that he's talking about it at all is enough to get an immense swath of support, including from people who usually vote Democrat. I get to hear a lot of this as a blogger, as someone who's kind of tapped into various political currency in the United States. There are a lot of people who will not admit to their friends that they're going to go vote Trump, because if they mention it to their friends, they're going to be shouted down, called racist, Nazis, etc. And it's the same thing. The rejection of neoliberal economics. Neoliberalism is the economic theory that insists that free trade is always good, trade barriers are always bad, the absolutely free movement of workers and capital is unalloyed good, blah, blah, blah. It's a theology, basically. It is like most modern economic theories. It's not actually based on fact. And that's been the orthodoxy welded in place across the Western world since the time of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And it has been very profitable for the affluent classes, because it's driven wages down, it's kept prices under control, it eliminated the inflation of the 1970s. And so it's been really, really good for the affluent. It's just that the working classes have been destroyed. Here in the United States, when I was young, okay, we're talking a few decades now, but back in the 1970s, in the United States, a working class family with one income could afford a house, they could afford a car, they could afford all the necessities of life, the three square meals a day, they could take the occasional vacation, afford the occasional luxury, they were doing pretty well. Nowadays, in today's America, a working class family with one income is living on the street. They've been ruined by the neoliberal economic policies that everyone insists are the only option. And so the backlash is really getting underway. And I think you're going to see it in country after country after country that has actually bought into neoliberalism. The countries that are exempt are the ones that have kind of made neoliberal noises and not done it. Japan's a great example. I mean, Japan is willing to talk neoliberalism as much as anybody, but try moving there to get a job. It is not easy. Japan does not have free and open borders for anyone who wants to move there, quite the contrary. And so they've basically avoided this whole thing. They've got major economic troubles as well, but that's because they built an export-based economy and then found out that, someone else could, mostly China, could undercut their prices. But they're not facing the same drastic schism in society that we're seeing all through Europe and in North America, where you have the affluent salary classes who have been very comfortable with the economics of the last 40 years, who have benefited hugely from it, and who insist that no other option is thinkable. And the great majority of the population that have been driven in face first into the gravel by those policies and are finally to the point of to switch metaphors, their backs are to the wall at this point. One more round of neoliberalism, their survival is at risk. And so they're starting to fight back. We're seeing the same thing going on in Europe right now. The Front National, Alternative für Deutschland over in Germany, all these various parties, what the thing that has caused them to be able to coalesce and become a significant force in European politics, a force that may well put, there's already put, people into the prime ministerships of a number of countries, and is probably going to do that in Italy and France in the near future, is precisely that neoliberal orthodoxy benefits the few at the expense of everyone else, and none of the mainstream parties are willing to talk about that. So people will turn to any party that does so. And, you know, in France, it's the Front National. In Italy, it's the Five Star Movement. And so on through the process. Any party that is willing to break with neoliberal economic orthodoxy, talk about the problems with unrestricted immigration and the free flow of capital, and suggest actual solutions, can count on an instant following. And I mean, the Five Star Movement in Italy, you've got a professional comedian running the thing, Beppe Grillo, okay? He's not a politician. How does this man suddenly lead the most popular party in Italy? Because he's the only one who's willing to talk about the downside of the neoliberal economic policies. The threat here is very simply that, again, let's say the French government, the French political class is able to crush the Front National, okay. That's not going to get rid of the discontents, it's not going to get rid of the problems, and the next person who rallies the French working class around them could have jackboots and an armband. The thing that's actually sort of funny in a very bleak sense about all this yelling about fascism, what created the fascist movements of the early 20th century? It was a specific economic orthodoxy that was driving the continent into economic ruin, but nobody's willing to change it. Again, it was the free trade orthodoxy of the Victorian era. Everybody insisted they had to do it, and because the only people who were willing to change that were people like Mussolini, Herr Hitler, Franco, and so on and so forth, they got into power. I would strongly encourage those people who insist that the modern, current neoliberal economic orthodox is the only option to realize that they could be preparing a rerun of the same phenomena.
Yeah, and the whole talk of European integration and unity was to avoid any things like that ever happening again.
Uh-huh. And the problem is that won't do that. What that could very well do is hand over an integrated, unified Europe into one big dictatorship. Just because it's big doesn't mean it's free from jackboots.
Well, I say one of the things that's most noticeable about this, I talked about the polarization of debates in the lead up to the British referendum, and you certainly see that in the American presidential run at the minute. Just everything has to be so black and white. It's a negation of nuance, isn't it? People don't want to hear blah, 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 but, or if this, then that. They just say, just tell me the answer. Just tell me everything will be all right. Just tell me, you know, one and one equals two, not it equals 4.5 or anything like that. I just want to know. And the problem is that's not how life is. There's very little in our, in the political and social realms and economics, environments, you name it, that is just straightforward. And that, unfortunately, that's what people want. They just want to know what the situation is so they can sleep at night.
Yeah. And that shows you just how much stress, just how much, how difficult life has become for a great many people. You know, we have to start by realizing there was never actually a recovery after the 2008-2009 economic crisis. There was a paper recovery. For many, many people, things have not improved since then. That's true here, it's true in large parts of Europe as well. The world, the industrial world is in deep trouble. The economics have not improved. Bailing out a lot of banks and patting themselves on the back for saving society may have made Barack Obama et al. Feel good, but it didn't actually solve any of the problems, and things have been getting very, very bad for a lot of people. So yeah, they're really stressed. They're frightened and deservedly so. And this is true across the spectrum. People are looking at the basic foundations of their society cracking under the strain of misplaced economic orthodoxies, of political systems that will not deal with the major problems facing society, and a range of other things. There's, you know, I'm sure the chaotic shifts in the global biosphere That's of course a subject for an entire talk of its own, but that has a lot of people very, very stressed, especially those who insist that it's not happening. Our anti-global warming people over here get more and more brittle with every unprecedented heat wave, every unprecedented round of flooding, you name it. People are under a lot of stress. When they're under that kind of stress, they want straightforward answers. They don't want vague mumbling, and especially they don't want the kind of vague mumbling that amounts to, well, we're just going to have to continue doing what we're doing. They're willing to take easy answers. They want easy answers, but the only answers that many of them are willing to hear are answers that involve changing something. Actually changing the way things are done. And unless if your political leaders are not willing to do that, your political leaders are going the way of David Cameron.
You see, this is what I find difficult at the minute dealing with this post-Brexit thing, is I see people, I've not had many of these conversations yet because I'm just starting to see people in the course of the few days and weeks mm-hmm. since all this happened, people I see occasionally. Mm-hmm. I see people, British nationals, but I also know a lot of people from mainland Europe, and mm-hmm. some of these people are not in a good place. If you were in town tonight, I could take you to meet a couple of people who are really upset about this. I mean, really emotional. They're in mm-hmm. they're in distress, and they're saying, is this my home anymore? I'm talking about people who are from abroad. And mm-hmm. it hurts me to watch them suffer like that. And yet, mm-hmm. if we were to have any conversations about, well, maybe this, the foundations of our society, the way things are done, business as usual, is actually starting to crack and shift a little bit, and we might have to change. I can see it in their eyes. There's, some of them are thinking, look, I've got kids, okay? I can't think about this,
And of course, that just adds to the strain. I've got kids, I can't think about this. But, the universe is, the world is not interested in whether we want to think about things. History does not care. And the fact that we don't think about things doesn't make them not happen. The idea of the ostrich burying its head in the sand, it's not a good strategy. I understand that it may be an emotionally necessary strategy. But part of my perspective here is that I see a lot of the other side of it. I live in a town in the mountains of Western Maryland, the North Central Appalachians, which used to be a factory town. It's exactly like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of towns across the north of England and the Midlands that used to be thriving factory towns that used to have lots of good steady jobs and now have none. The factories are gone. The jobs are gone. Most of the buildings downtown are boarded up. And people have been, they've been on the other end of the equation from the people that you've talked about, the people from who are from continental Europe, who are going, is this my home anymore? What am I, what am I going to do? What does this mean? They've seen their lives ruined by decades of policies that encouraged immigration and encouraged the offshoring of jobs. And, in Britain, in America, in a lot of other places, their backs are to the wall, and they can't just say, I can't think about that anymore. They have to think about it. They have to think about where their next meal is coming from. Because, everything's being cut. Benefits are being cut. All kinds of the various stopgap measures to try to keep body and soul together, those are faltering now as our society moves deeper and deeper into crisis. And so Donald Trump comes along. If you were over here, I could take you down into the poor end of Cumberland. Cumberland's a poor town, but it has wealthier and poorer ends. I live right on the edge of the poorest part of town. And I'll show you, rundown housing, shuttered storefronts, a street that used to be a thriving business street and is now mostly empty except for the taverns. Mm-hmm. And the Trump signs are springing up like mushrooms. And people who insist, and you get this in America, just as you get this in Britain, people who insist that Trump or the Remain, or the Leave campaign, it's entirely these wealthy right-wing interests, blah, blah, blah. They need to come down to places like this. They need to go to the equivalent places in the north of England and talk to the people who have been getting the short end of the stick for 40 years. Talk to the people who have the Trump signs in their yards or who, you know, hung out the red cross on a white background when the whole Brexit thing blew up. Talk to them and find out what their vision is, if you can get them to talk. And it's not easy because first of all, you have to convince them that you're not going to just start sneering at them and screaming at them, insisting they must be Nazis. If you can get them to talk, you're going to hear a really savage story about how they've been lied to and betrayed and cheated and had their future and their children's future taken away from them by policies that were, you know, presented in Whitehall or in Washington, D.C. as, you know, this is great, this will be great for the economy, prosperity for all, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, prosperity for all the prosperous. And there's a lot of people on the left who are not willing to make that walk, who are not willing to go and listen to the people.
In the political scene comparing the UK with the US, the current leader of the Labour Party here is a chap called Jeremy Corbyn. Mm-hmm. You have Bernie Sanders, who's he's running against Clinton for the nomination over there mm-hmm. in the States, both kind of more or less, we could call them socialists, and both actually find that their own parties in terms of representatives, not in terms of the party members, you know, the average Joe on the street, but in terms mm-hmm. of party members, they are going hammer and tongs to run them out of town. Beyond any of that, do you think that are they manifestations of something similar, perhaps, as characters?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Because Corbyn's a great example because, your Labour Party has a more or less democratic structure, and that's nice. Our Democratic Party doesn't. If the nomination campaign for the Democratic candidate had been fair, honest, and open, Bernie Sanders would be the nominee at this point. The number of blatant irregularities that were needed to basically stuff Clinton down the voters' throats, it's just, even American politics has been corrupt since the time of George Washington. Okay, we need, you know, that's just basic. Voting fraud is as American as apple pie. This was extreme even by American standards. But in both cases, yeah, the party apparatchiks loathe them because the party apparatchiks are all part of that movement that sold out the working classes in the 1980s and 1990s to reorient toward the influence of affluent liberals. And gambling in the process that the working class would keep on voting for them out of misplaced loyalty or habit or just because they were 1.1 millimeter better than the Tories or the Republicans, respectively. And so now you have somebody like Corbyn, who comes in, who wins the leadership poll by a landslide when it's up to the regular membership. And of course, all the PMP, the Parliamentary Labour Party is out for its blood. But all he has to do is say, okay, we can take it back to another election within the party and we can see what the average Joes want. And all of a sudden, the attempted coup crumpled because they know perfectly well that anybody who ran against Corbyn at this point would be destroyed. And the thing that I think they're afraid of, the MPs on the Labour Party are all saying, oh, there's no way that Corbyn can win a general election. Au contraire, I think they're terrified that he can. Because I think they know perfectly well that if he goes into number 10 with a mandate from the voters, he will have the power to bring back some of what the Labour Party used to be about, like, you know, the things that benefit the laboring classes. What a concept! And that means that their comfortable gravy train is out the door. That means that the consensus of the affluent is no longer the only game in town. They're terrified by that. I wish Corbyn all the best. If I were in, if I were a British subject, I would run right out and join the Labour Party so I could vote for the man. I would have very much liked to vote for Bernie Sanders, but unless Hillary Clinton manages to lose herself the nomination somehow, it looks like I'm not going to have that chance.
Maybe it's just the circles I move in, but I've got quite a few friends in America and mm-hmm. they're all aghast. Maybe it's because like attracts like. They're all aghast at what's going on. They cannot believe the selection that's been put in front of them. They all, to a greater or lesser extent, would like Sanders to come through because he thinks he's the least worst option. In Britain, yeah. my friends are saying, I don't know anybody that's rah, rah, rah for the Tories. Certainly not for UKIP. And I don't even know very many people who are anything other than, well, yeah, Corbyn would be the least worst option. So, you know, but as you say, it's possibly because the people who are not in that group I'm describing are not talking about what they think.
Because sometimes, if you're willing to take the risk, okay, sometimes when you're in a conversation, bring up, with some of your friends, bring up the economic problems with immigration. Watch the reaction. You may be lucky. Maybe somebody will stop and say, yeah, you know, you've got a point there, but here are these other reasons why we need immigration. Most circles you do that, you will be shouted down and accused of being a racist. Certainly in America, if you breathe the suggestion that, unrestricted immigration is not a totally good thing, you will be yelled down and accused of being a racist and a Nazi and a drooling idiot. And again, back to the schoolboy insult. So there's a very good reason why you only hear one thing. But one of the consequences is that there's this echo chamber effect where the people whose voices, quote, are acceptable are all talking among themselves, and everything seems just fine. Everyone agrees on this, that, and the other. And nobody notices how many people there are outside that circle who do not agree and who have very good reasons not to agree. So one of the great problems with this tendency to defend, what I've called the consensus of the affluent, by shouting down the opposition, any opposition with insults, is that you get a bubble chamber effect, and so you're going to get blindsided by things like the Brexit vote. That's in full roar here in the United States, of course. Watching people in the pundits in the media, big names on the internet, all being just totally dismissive of the thought that the American people could possibly vote for Donald Trump, when more and more Americans are lining up behind Donald Trump. Come November, if things continue the way they're going, they're going to be just left the way so many people you know are left over the Brexit thing, just with their mouths hanging open in agony. Because how could people have voted for this man who we called, a racist moron? Well, maybe the people were not listening to you. Maybe the people had reasons of their own. Maybe the people don't care what the approved opinion makers think. And that's kind of traumatic if you're used to living in an echo chamber.
Thinking back to what you wrote recently about all this, thinking of your quoting from Arnold Toynbee's A Study of History, you point out what he says that this society's in decline, schism into two unequal parts, a dominant minority that monopolizes the political system and its payoffs, and an internal proletariat that carries most of the cost of the existing order and is denied access to most of its benefits. As the schism develops, the dominant minority loses track of the fundamental law of politics, and the masses will only remain loyal if their leaders remain loyal to them. And one of the side effects of this schism, as you point out, is that things of genuine concern, like the environment, for example, they tend to get shoved to one side. And you find when you go to recycling centres, you get a certain type of people trying to do environmentally friendly things. People who've got their own allotment, people who are growing plants or vegetables in pots in their backyard, people who are going to lectures on environmental awareness, and it tends to be a certain section of society, people who drive Toyota Prius or whatever, who are trying to to factor in, for whatever reason, trying to factor in some of these aspects into their lives, probably really trying to help, coming from a good place. Yes, I'd like to do something. Mm-hmm. But you don't get a lot of those people steel workers that have been hoofed out of their job, lining up at the salad counter for more mung beans or whatever, however you want to put it.
Now, that's actually a huge issue, and it's one that I'm going to be addressing in an upcoming post.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the massive problems we face is that the environmental movement since the end of the 1970s has been affected by the same co-optation on the behalf of the affluent. All of the changes that have been pushed through to improve the environment who has carried the costs of them? Who has had to carry the burdens? Now, I'm going to give a specific example here. How come none of these people who are talking so eagerly about the environment are discussing shutting down non-essential air travel? That produces vast amounts of carbon. I mean, flying someplace on a jet has a bigger carbon footprint per mile than any other way of travel. Okay? It's huge. It's a massive contributor to our global warming, and of course it doesn't help that it's producing that and other gases way up in the air, so things can rise right up into parts of the atmosphere where they can do the most damage. Okay? Why is nobody talking about this? And the reason for that is that air travel is a privilege of the affluent. No, we have to shut down coal mines. That places a burden on the poor. Since the 1970s, the environmental movement has focused on placing the costs of environmental protection on the poor while shielding equally polluting, equally damaging things that benefit the affluent. And that's the reason why the poor have turned their back on the environmental movement. Because as far as they can tell, it's just another way to push more costs on them and to have the benefits trickle up into the comfortable classes.
You point out also, earlier, I was reminded of this earlier when you were talking about party loyalties becoming fluid and that, you know, if we're not careful, you could end up with UKIP, Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. However, extremely unlikely it seems. Now, I would not have put a buck on Donald Trump ever becoming president. You know, I just said, I'm not going to lose a dollar. I'm not doing it, you know. Whereas now it's looking like, well, I should have put $1,000 on it, you know. But in some ways, and I see this from lots of sections of this debate at the minute, whether it's politicians who are being quite duplicitous and not really speaking their minds, or whether it's through ordinary, interested, engaged people who are wondering how we respond to all this. And it's like they don't want to placate what they feel are sections of society that they might judge along the lines you described as, you know, as being racist or xenophobes or whatever they feel. But we don't want to give them anything because then we'll be just giving in to them. But on the other hand, as far as the threat from UKIP and what have you goes, I mean, they need to stop poking the wasp's nest because more of the jabbing sticks in the wasp's nest is not going to calm the wasps down.
Yeah, and this whole thing, we can't give them anything. That's the whole problem. Because what you're saying is we're not going to give the poor anything. We're not going to give the desperate anything. We're not going to give anything to the hopeless. Why do people align with these extreme movements? Because they're poor, because they're desperate, because they're hopeless, because nothing else offers them any way to look toward a better future. That's what drove fascism in the 1920s and 1930s. You know, the guy in the jackboots with the armband was the only person out there who's saying, we can fix this, we will change society, we will change the economic system, and we will make it better for you. The thing nobody talks about, Mussolini, Hitler, their lesser equivalents in other countries, one of the main things they did was boost wages, improve working conditions. The Nazi Party that's where every worker in Germany had vacation time. They put that into place. This is one of those things. They were a party oriented toward the masses of Germans, and they actually provided major benefits. Of course, they did a few other things that we all know about too, which outweighed that in very important ways. I grant that. But the fact is, for the ordinary German, until the war actually started getting ugly on their side, until the bombers started rolling over, for the ordinary German, the Nazi Party was a great thing. It got Germany out of its economic prostration. It provided better wages. If you had a problem with your employer, you could go to the local party and office that coordinated industry and labor and talk to them and often get it resolved. And so it was because of that that they were able to become so popular, so powerful, that they were able to, you know, sweep across Europe. If you don't want to give anything to the poor and desperate, you're going to be facing something like that again.
Don't remember exactly which one of your books I read from a few years ago, but you mentioned when we find ourselves in the sort of position we're in now, maybe a bit earlier than some of us thought. I think your phrase might have been charismatic demagogue, that this is a sort of political leader that would arise. And I remember watching Mike Judge's film Idiocracy a few years ago and thinking, oh yeah, you know, imagine if it ever gets like this. And then somebody wrote an online article recently doing parallels between Idiocracy and the US right now. And it was kind of scary, but there you go. Trump is for many people the definition of a charismatic demagogue.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, in fact, that's what gives him his power. He's not doing an ordinary campaign. And this is the Republicans who were competing against him were totally flustered by this. They were doing everything in the sort of approved, regular, mainstream way. And Trump just walked right past them because he was appealing directly to the voters instead of trying to move the levers of the machinery. You get, you know, in times like this, somebody who can speak directly to the people and talk about things that matter to them is going to walk right past the other political candidates. The question then simply becomes, what kind of person is he? What kind of leader is he going to be? We've had quite a few charismatic demagogues in American history. FDR, Francis Roosevelt was one of them. Our famous President Roosevelt, the guy, he was kind of America's answer to Mussolini, except that he was better at hiring generals and didn't erase the Constitution. But, you know, he was president for four terms, and if he hadn't died in the fourth one, if he hadn't died, he'd probably still be president today. His power was a function. These fireside chats, he had these radio chats. Every week, he'd be on the radio talking to the American people directly, going right around the political thing. Charismatic, you bet. Franklin, by the way, I got messed up his name sometimes. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And is Trump another FDR? Heck of a good question. FDR was criticized in savage terms by the establishment of his time. One of the terms, you could talk about class issues in those days, so everyone denounced him as a traitor to his class. Well, you know, yeah, he was. But it got him into the White House and kept him there for the rest of his life. Trump is another rich man who has figured, as FDR was, who has figured out how to speak to the needs of the poor, the needs and interests and fears and concerns. And so, yeah, it's something that happens routinely when a political system freezes up into the kind of failed consensus that we're seeing now. There is a harsher term for it that Oswald Spengler, the theorist of historical cycles, gave. He called it Caesarism, because Julius Caesar was another example of the time. I mean, Julius Caesar, his power came from the Roman masses. He appealed right over the top of the political system to them directly, and that's why the conspiracy that assassinated him was composed entirely of rich guys.
Yeah.
So it's a common historical phenomenon, and the one real risk you run is what kind of person are you going to get? Are you going to get somebody like FDR, who for all his problems actually did work very hard at solving this country's problems and left the Constitution intact? Are you going to get a genial blowhard like Mussolini? Are you going to get a psychopathic mass murderer like Adolf Hitler? It's a crapshoot, because you certainly can't tell from the fact that a guy is charismatic and is able to tap into the things that nobody's willing to talk about. You can't tell just from that, okay, what is this guy going to do once he's in power? We don't know. But we do know that business as usual is not working for a very large number of people. And the people who insist that business as usual is the only option are the people who are basically making the charismatic demagogue the only choice. If in fact Donald Trump becomes president, if he wins the November election, he's inaugurated next January, the people who will have done the most to make that happen are Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Party, because they have systematically shut down every other option that's available to people who can't endure the continuation of a failed status quo.
Well, referring back to what I was saying earlier on, people I consider to be friends, people I've known for quite a long time, even people I've known for a very long time, that if they are pro-EU, and I say I don't know anybody that was strongly anti, whatever the EU's problems, however Baroque and Byzantine the structures and the procedures become, that they're attached, the people I know, to like an ideal. And as I say, that stands at variance with a lot of reality is almost like, it's not that it doesn't matter, but it's still almost like an ideal being what it is. You can always find a way to, in its insubstantial nature, you can always find a way to hold it above day-to-day reality and say, yes, but this is the shining torch of what the EU, what the EU is supposed to be, what it was meant to be, what it stands for.
Now, understood. But the problem is when that becomes an excuse for ignoring what it, what the EU is actually doing, then you have a recipe for a political explosion. And so, the, you know, politics is not about the ideal. Politics is politics is about the possible. It's about the real. It's about what you can actually make happen. And so to some extent, this kind of, this the political idealism, it's very common. It has its place. But again, when it becomes an excuse to not talk about the human cost of these policies, then something has gone very wrong.
Yeah, I just hope that that people who started out at the top of this interview with us are kind of still here, particularly if they know.
Trust me, I know.
Particularly if they know me personally, because I'm not trying to turn people off with some of the ideas and the terms we've bandied around. I'm trying to understand this in a more nuanced way. I just think it's not black and white, and there's a lot more to this. So I'm trying to work my way through it, and take other people with me. You know.
And that's the thing. If the EU or something like it is going to fulfill the role that it's been given, you know, in terms of its ideals, in terms of what it stands for, the consequences of its actions have got to be taken into account. You've got to stop and say, okay, how are we going to express this ideal in a way that does not drive our working classes into destitution and misery? How are we going to make this work in the real world? And the, one of the problems is that, again, this is not something, human beings have such mixed motives. Because on the one hand, there's the ideal. On the other hand, there's the fact that if you're comfortably well off, those ideals have a lot of practical benefits. You know, you can go, I think some of the people who were complaining at the, to the media after the Brexit vote saying, well, but I want my kids to be able to, you know, to go to college in Germany or wherever. I want to be able to take my vacations and right there, you're looking at people who, I mean, children from Brixton are not going to be going to college in Germany. And people in the formerly industrial north of Britain are not going to be traveling to Spain for vacations. So you start seeing how the costs and benefits of this ideal sort out, and it's necessary to actually look at that grubby reality and say, okay, who's getting the benefits of this? Who's paying the cost? If we want to maintain the ideal, how can we make its expression more equitable?
Okay, can these people that you're, I know you're characterizing it fairly simply just to make a point.
And, oh, yeah, you know, just to get the point across. Of course, it's more complex in the real world.
Yeah. So can these people find common cause? You know, particularly if one person is a, I don't know, on his way to play golf at the club, he stops off at the corner shop to get some cigarettes, and he really likes the Polish guy who runs the shop. But you know what I mean? Can these people ever come together?
Well, it's going to take a lot. It's not going to be a fast process, because on the one hand, the guy who's on his way to golf, he has his beliefs, he has his ideals, he thinks he knows the way the world works, and he's also used to thinking about, you know, the British poor in a very specific way, and the people, you know, drive 10 miles in a different direction into the remnants of an old industrial area and talk to the people there. They have a very different take on things. They've got their habits of thought, which are not necessarily well educated under the circumstances. How could they be? And they've got their prejudices and their ideas. And what I think needs to happen more than anything else is that that everybody's voice needs to be heard. Because you can't even start bringing people together until you allow everybody to actually have a voice. You can't have a conversation when the talk is being monopolized by one side. And I think that's the great lesson of the whole Brexit business, which is that if you insist that only one point of view can be brought up publicly, then you're going to be blindsided by the people who've been told to shut up but will not sit down. So, yes, I think there can be a coming together, but it's going to be a long, slow process. It has to start with admitting the fact that there's more than one point of view here. There's more than one way of looking at things. There's more than one way to look at the benefits and the costs, and that the whole spectrum of views, the spectrum of the guy in Brixton, the spectrum of the guy in Leeds, the spectrum of the perspectives of all these people, as well as, you know, the affluent liberals, affluent moderates, and affluent conservatives who basically monopolized the political dialogue for decades now. All voices have to be heard. Once all voices have heard, then you have a conversation, which is what we call politics. And gradually you hammer your way to a compromise in which nobody gets everything they want and everyone gets what they desperately need. At least in theory, that's how it works. Is it going to happen easily? No. Is there going to be vast amounts of screaming? Are there going to be schoolyard insults flung by all sides? Yes, of course. We're human beings. We're not angels. I think there can be a coming together, but it's got to start with accepting the fact that there's more than one point of view that they can get deserves to get a word in.
Well, I mean, I played golf for years, and a confession time, Tarama Salata, I like that. I know what it is. Garden centers, mm-hmm. Frappuccinos, Toyota Prius, art galleries, mm-hmm. recycling, free cycling. I even used to read The Guardian, for God's sake. You know, that's my life. I wondered, yeah. Is it immutable? Is that just, can I live out the rest of my life exactly in that way? And I've been questioning it seriously. Well, probably since the 1980s, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where I am. So I understand that I'm carrying, even though I try mm-hmm. to be aware of it, I try to be conscious of it, I'll be carrying some of the thought patterns that you're referring to, some of the attitudes,
Of course. And you will, and the people who voted for Brexit are carrying their own burden of attitudes and prejudices and assumptions. Everybody does. Nobody has, we all have our own partial views, we all have our own fragmentary grasp on what's actually going on. And one of the reasons that systems, what we will call democracy, by which I don't mean real democracy, pure democracy, but actual democracy as it happens, the grubby reality of party politics and elections and things like that, one of the reasons that that is a slightly better system of government than any of the others is that it can potentially give a voice to more of these partial visions, more of these different views. So, adding them all together, a more complete view of what's actually going on becomes possible.
Well, I mean, the debates here in the run-up to the referendum was very ugly and ill-tempered. And to be honest with you, mm-hmm. I feel in some ways the aftermath has been more so, because walking around the streets now, it's a bit like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, people are wondering, is that other person over them, are they real, or is it one of them? Do you know what I mean?
Invasion of the Brexit Snatchers. I can see it now.
Well, it's us, it's that lack of trust, I guess.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, this is one of the things you get when you have a consensus that everyone's supposed to accept, and you suddenly find out that there are people who disagree with you. Like, seriously, and it's not just, this out-group, everybody has their out-group. Here in America, liberal Americans, it's rednecks, southern rednecks, they're the out-group against which it is totally okay in liberal circles to engage in those vicious hate speech, by the way. Everybody has their out-group who they can assign wrong ideas to, but when you suddenly are forced to realize that 52% of the people around you, or 52% of the people in your country, at least, voted for something that you really disagreed with, then you actually have to recalibrate and say, okay, there are actual differences of opinion. Deep, profound, enduring. How do we function as a society in that case? Well, we start by accepting the fact that those differences are real and that the people who hold those opinions are not just Lord Voldemort and the Death Eaters, okay? They're not just evilly evil for the sake of sheer evilness. They've got reasons. Just like we have reasons for our opinions, and some of those reasons are idealistic, and some of those reasons are selfish. We're human beings. That's not avoidable. And so then we sit down and say, okay, how are we going to make this work? And then we get into party politics and the fun of democracy, and we try to make something happen. It'd be nice if there were an easy answer. As far as I know, there isn't one.
Well, as we begin to wind things up for today, John, I mean, here in the UK, certainly, you know, obviously Prime Minister Cameron recently resigned, you know, immediately after the vote went the quote-unquote wrong way. And then you had the heir apparent, Boris Johnson, who was run out of town. And you've had other people who took part in the campaign, the Brexit campaign, who've fallen by the wayside. We now have a lineup, a rather unedifying lineup of two women candidates for leadership of the Conservative Party. And whoever's elected will automatically become Prime Minister until such times as there's another general election. But very much, I think someone used the phrase in relation to Boris Johnson. It was like, who wants the poison chalice? You know, who wants this crown of thorns now that, you know, they were all notable by their absence as soon as this actually blew up. I think actually someone like Boris Johnson was also assuming that the Leave campaign would not succeed and that, but he would again do what I said, Cameron would do. He'd hold up his hands and say, well, I tried. And he would look heroic for doing it in the eyes of his supporters.
And no, I think it was a shock to the entire political class to find out that just, you know, that they, you know, you can only play your games for so long and then suddenly somebody grabs it and makes it real. And yeah, very likely there's a lot of people wondering what to do at this point. Your comment about an unedifying lineup is very apropos. I occasionally read the Daily Mash, the British humor website, and I recall an article a little while ago noting, could we please have a female head of state who doesn't hate all our guts?
Well, that's that old thing of, you know, when women go into politics and they suddenly cease to become women in some ways, the kind of femininity goes out. You know, anything that the things that make men and women different, which are are quite valuable, they just get jettisoned. You know, because you have to be this, you have to be this hard ass bitch.
You have to be tougher and more masculine than the men in order to compete with them. Yeah, Hillary Clinton here, she's being described as a velociraptor in a pantsuit, and not inappropriately.
Yeah, quite okay. John, final point. I'm going to put you on the spot
final
here.
Final point.
Put you on the spot. If you'd been in the UK, would you have voted Leave or Remain?
It would have been a very difficult choice, but I would have voted Leave. All things considered, between the profoundly undemocratic nature of the EU, the fact that it's very obviously trying to move toward becoming a European superstate in which the voice of the voters has no power, the major problems with unrestricted immigration and capital flow, the likelihood that voting Remain would might well have put Nigel Farage into number 10 Downing Street, which is not something that I particularly wanted to see happen. There would be a range of reasons. It would not have been an easy vote, but I would have voted to leave.
Okay, well, I can see how we might have undone all our good work here, because people will be pointing at the computer now going, I knew it, she's a Nazi!
But that's the thing. I would hope that everybody who went into the voting booth at that thing had been thinking through all the issues, the things that the EU did that were good, the things the EU has done that are very dangerous, the thing pro and con, and not just doing a knee-jerk vote one way or the other. I'm afraid that probably didn't happen in a lot of cases, but, you know, that's the situation.
Okay, John, as far as I know, last time I spoke to you, you don't have a website as such, but you've got your blog, which you you update every week unless you're on vacation or something like that. And tell people about that. And I believe you've got a new book coming out in the not-too-distant future.
I always have a new book coming out. The blog is The Arch Druid Report, http://thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. If you simply do a search for Arch Druid Report on your favorite search engine, it'll be on the first page. It's basically every Wednesday night, Eastern time, I put up a new essay, and then the conversations begin. And let's see, the book that's coming out shortly is a nice, cheery, heartwarming title, Dark Age America, Climate Change, Cultural Collapse, and the Hard Future Ahead. Basically, taking the current trajectory of decline and fall, in which the United States is very obviously engaged, and spanning that forward over the next 500 years or so to try to imagine what kind of world we're actually heading into. Not Star Trek future, not Mad Max, but the normal aftermath of a failed civilization. It's heartwarming is a joke. It's probably my most uncompromising book to date, but it said some things that I think very badly need to be heard.
Okay, well, maybe I can persuade you to have a conversation about that when the time comes.
I would be delighted to do so.
Splendid. Okay, well, until then, John, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
And thank you very much for having me.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com. Where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.